This is Memory Static, a podcast where we dig up all the old movies you loved and watching when you were little, talk about them, and throw a party to watch them. And there's also an original song at the end. We don't ever talk about that. Okay, so it's me, the host of the thing, and Bailey Moore. And I'm here with a very good friend of mine, our guest, Aaron Price.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. When you asked me to be the special guest, it was a week and a half ago and I had a cold. And I said, in a week and a half from now, my voice will be normal. But here it is. Not quite normal.
It's not quite normal, but it still sounds good.
Thank you.
Aaron and I know each other through working for a camp called Camp Half-Blood. That's not the normal kind of typical summer camp, wouldn't you agree?
No, it's very odd.
No, it's based on the Percy Jackson books, and so all you Percy Jackson fans out there, Camp Half-Blood is real and in Austin, Texas. Yeah?
Yeah, it's very real. Every aspect of it is very real.
Can you describe what camp is like?
I guess the short version is we take some elements of the book, about 10% from the book, and about 90% we just make up and mix with Greek mythology. And then we have a bunch of kids and we do camp activities mixed with Greek mythology storytelling and real life character improv and performance art, sort of. So there's like a plot, but also we do camp activities like archery.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big mess.
Yeah. You know, yeah. So it's bringing the books to life.
I would say that's a concise way to put it.
And so the reason why I bring this up is because for me, you were there when the camp started.
Yeah.
You were a camper.
That's true.
And now you're a counselor. And I just kind of intruded and walked right in as a counselor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Intruded. I've done it for several years now. And for me, it feels like just one endless summer. It's like there are little things that change, but you kind of just step right back in and it feels like you haven't been gone.
Yes, it is a little seamless. We work maybe 8 weeks or 10 weeks every summer. And it does feel the first week of every summer feels like yesterday was the last week of last summer.
Yeah.
And it's very strange in that way.
Which is like the Neverland, slow moving time machine. You say?
Oh, whatever.
You guessed wrong.
The slow moving time machine. I'm trying to go with
no
podcast
Neverland.
Canon.
Neverland.
It is like Neverland. That's what I was going to say.
I'm glad that's what you were going to say.
Listen, I'm not just a guest. I'm a listener.
So, Aaron, what are we going to be watching tonight?
Today, I believe we're going to watch Hook.
You believe?
Robin Williams.
Yes. And?
And several other very famous people.
Yeah, that's true. So why did you choose Hook?
I chose Hook. This is not an original origin story, I know, but it was the most battered VHS at my grandfather's, in my grandfather's VHS drawer that he had exclusively to keep us busy when we were at his house. And for some reason, it was just me and my brother's favorite VHS. And we would plug it into his little tiny VHS TV and just watch the hell out of this video over and over again.
Is that the first way that you watched it? It was on VHS?
Yeah. Yeah. On a little like integrated VHS, you know, box TV.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Bonafide. You know, I actually saw the movie for the first time in the theater, but it wasn't in the normal theater. It was the dollar theater, which I don't even know if there are dollar theaters anymore. And if there are, you have to look for them. No, you've never heard of a dollar theater. Well, when I was little, my mom would just drop my sister and I off at the dollar theater in the summers as kind of our daycare. It's just for the duration of a movie, but like she would get her errands done while we would watch all sorts of movies, and we watched Grease and we watched Pinocchio and whatever. But the instance that I watched Hook was not by ourselves at the Dollar Theater. It was actually my grandparents came into town and they wanted us to take us to do something fun. And so they took us to the Dollar Theater and we watched Hook.
That's something fun.
Yeah, it was great.
This is a grandparents introducing to grandchildren movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was and I mean, I loved the movie right away. How about you?
Yeah, I don't remember the first time I ever saw it because it was a repeated viewing situation. Like we watched it over and over, but I definitely, it was not something that had to grow on me. It's immediately endearing and captivating.
Do you have any specific memories that are kind of related to watching the movie?
I mean, it's been a long time since I was in my grandfather's house, but even just whenever I think about Hook, I'm immediately in that room. Which is because I've never watched this movie outside of that room.
How long has it been since you watched it?
Maybe 10 or 15 years.
Oh, great. I'm excited.
Yeah. But I remember it very well. I'm warning you now. This is not like I don't remember the details.
Oh,
I remember everything.
No, I can kind of, I believe you. And I feel like I can relate because, I watch these movies to research them before the interview and everything. And I hadn't seen Hook, and I can't remember how long either. But while I was watching it, I was quoting it.
I remember lots of specific lines from it. Not to brag, but, you know.
Oh, what's your favorite?
My favorite by far is when Rufio says, "You are the pan." That has stuck with me for years and years and years. And my second favorite line is, when Maggie Smith says, "Oh, Peter, you've forgotten how to fly," which is at the very beginning.
Peter, you've become a pirate.
I don't remember that. Okay, I thought I remembered everything.
I'm not going to tell you. I won't tell you.
I'm excited to see it again tonight. I have not seen it in full in a long time.
Anything you don't remember, I'm not going to ruin that for you.
Please don't.
So I remember one of the things that really stood out to me. Well, a memory that came back while I was rewatching the movie was that I learned the word epiphany from Hook.
Epiphany.
Yes. Because Smee goes, "I think I've had an apostrophe."
Oh.
Yeah.
You said that a minute ago before
yes,
we started recording,
off mic.
And I did not get it. It just whooshed. And he said, "This guy doesn't remember Hook."
No, that's okay. You haven't seen it in 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I don't remember that. I think that falls into the category of things I would not have gotten as a kid.
Yeah. I think
that just went right over my head.
Well, I didn't understand the joke at all, but the word stood out to me because I didn't know what the word was. And it's so punctuated within the dialogue that I think I might have asked my parents what it meant. And it probably still took me a moment to really understand it.
Wow, Smee. I forgot about Smee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it just like I had the idea like epiphany means, you know, a light turns on. Bing.
Yeah.
Like in the Looney Tunes.
Light bulb.
Yeah, exactly. So do you remember any parts not lines, but like moments in the movie that really you remember very vividly?
I of course, yes. There are so many shots that stick with you, like in order, I would say like when the hook lock on the door unlatches at the beginning of the movie, it's very scary.
Yes.
It's terrifying.
Yes.
And you don't see Hook in that scene, but you see the hook lock. That's hard to describe. It's
on
like
the window.
It's like a latch that looks like a Captain hook. Hook's hook that comes up from the doorknob. And it's just like, ooh, why does it look like that? What? And then, yes, like I remember Rufio very well. Rufio was me and my brother's favorite guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him, my favorite line that goes with it. I remember him kneeling and holding up the sword and...
crying.
And for some reason, what comes to mind is the scene that I know as a kid I did not understand, which is Tinkerbell talking about the way she feels towards Peter Pan as an adult. And even now, I don't remember it very well because I don't think I understood it.
I think I still don't really understand it.
Really? Okay, I'm interested to see it.
I mean, we could talk about it.
I mean, I remember the gist of it. I don't want to get ahead of it. But
I have some theories.
But my as a kid, it was like, what are they talking about? Like, there's a scene where Tinkerbell is sort of being awfully adult with her emotions towards Robin Williams as Peter Pan. And it's confusing. And as a kid, I remember it because of that.
Yeah.
Because it was this interesting, I remember it as an interlude where it's like, there's no kids throwing stuff at each other. Now it's Julia Roberts saying, you know, being a little mopey towards Peter Pan. I don't remember. Well, I don't remember. I'm dying to.
Let's say at the end, after we've watched the movie, let's revisit it.
Please.
Okay. What's the next question? The next question is, did the story, before we move on, gosh, I wanted to, like, coming back to the window thing.
The
hook on the window.
Oh yeah.
We talked about this before, when you first told me that you wanted to do this movie, mm-hmm. how, I always really, I was a weird kid and I really liked exposition, and the exposition of movies was often, if it had really good exposition, they were my favorite parts of the movie, mm-hmm. because it was the anticipation and the excitement and the buildup.
Yes.
And I think Hook does it excellently. The whole beginning of the movie, like when the scary part happens, mm-hmm. and you haven't seen Hook, it is very creepy.
You are unsure what the rules of this reality are at this point.
Yes, because it's not the world that we live in.
It's the real world, but we know it's not going to be exactly the real world. And then the hook comes up from the doorknob, and you're just like, anything goes right now. I don't know what the rules are.
Right.
And is Hook real? Is Neverland real? I don't know at this point. We don't know anything. That's very cool.
Yeah.
And then they reveal sort of what's going on in this universe. But
yeah. Yeah. So that was the part that I really remember liking. Okay. Now moving on to that question. I interrupted myself in the middle of, did the story of Peter Pan, you know, not necessarily Hook, but Peter Pan story, did it capture your imagination when you were young? Was it significant to you in a certain way?
So this is a mystery about why I liked Hook, is that I never watched, read, or even knew the story of Peter Pan.
Really?
Ever. Yeah.
Wow. How did you miss it?
I just completely missed it. And like, I knew what it was, but I what I knew was there's a kid in a silly green suit, and he zooms around, and there's fairy dust,
and that's it.
And there's Wendy, and she's wearing night clothes.
And you didn't care to, you know, find out anything more?
Well, everything I know about Peter Pan, I will say to this day, everything I know about Peter Pan, I know from Hook.
Really?
Yes.
That's wild.
Yes.
I'm kind of blown away right now.
It doesn't make sense.
Because I loved Peter Pan well before I ever knew Hook. And I think that was like what led me to really love Hook, was because I'd never seen anything that gave backstory to a familiar story and, like, you know, allowed Peter Pan to grow up. And, you know, like, it was like, what if, you know, what if the story continued? Like, what happens after the end? And like that, like, really captured my imagination, because when I was little, this is a secret.
Okay.
When I was little, when I was little, I really wished that Peter Pan would come to my window and take me away to Neverland.
Yeah.
And I completely, like, I willfully ignored the fact that it was a boys' club.
I see you are hitting upon my ignorance. I know I know the Lost Boys are all boys.
Yes, they're all
boys.
But
Wendy is a girl.
Yeah, Wendy, I think that it was just like, I don't know, that was an odd thing. She was the only girl that Peter Pan ever took, and that's like part of that story. Mm. I just ignored that And then, you know, when I got older, like Peter Pan changed into vampires. like some handsome vampire is going to come to my window.
Wow. What literature inspired that? Like what seeded that?
Oh, this is very embarrassing.
This is way before Twilight.
No, it is. But can you think of another like vampire series?
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
No.
Okay, books.
Yeah, books. Okay, so well before it ever came to television, I read the series The Vampire Diaries.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, my aunt read them, gave them to my mom. My mom read them and gave them to me. And I read them over and over and over and over again.
Wow.
Sixth grade.
Well, for me, it was getting the letter from Hogwarts. But
yeah, I'm older than you. Yeah. I think, I was in high school when Harry Potter came to my attention. Yeah, okay. Well, let's move on. Okay, so one more question before we can retreat into the slow-moving time machine. What was your perception of being an adult when you were a kid?
That's a big question, obviously, way outside the confines of this interview about Hook. But I think, like a lot of people, being an adult was a lot about, well, what are you going to grow up to be? Meaning, what job are you going to have? And, you know, I don't want to weave too convenient of a narrative here, but that is something Hook picks up on, is at the very beginning, the reason we know Robin Williams is a boring adult, even though he's not boring at all, he's very fun as an adult, is that he has this job, right? And it's just like, oh, he's on his cell phone for his job. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that we're supposed to see is like, oh, he's lost his way. Oh, he has a job. Which is very real to me right now because I just got my first real job that I've had in a while. So maybe I am finally growing up and maybe this is such a great time for me to see Hook again.
Soon you'll get a cell phone.
Oh, gosh.
All downhill.
See, I can see so vividly in my head right now. There's this. I don't know when cell phones happened relative to Hook, but it must have been new-ish because there's this whole bit where they're like Robin Williams draws his cell phone like he's in a
like
Wild
a quick
West.
Draw.
Yeah, like a quick draw situation, and it's such a funny bit because cell phones are so new and novel, and look at all these people with jobs and their cell phones. Anyway, that's a digressing. But I guess, yeah, you know that if there's one thing that literature about kids, with kids being the heroes, hammers into you, it's that adults are boring and they don't get things that kids get. They just don't get it.
Yeah.
They tell you that you don't get things that they get.
Mm-hmm.
You'll understand when you're older. But what they don't get is that there's this whole thing that only kids get.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I definitely felt that way as a kid, and that theme is in Hook for sure, especially at the beginning.
Yeah, I think when I was little, kids wanted to play house, and I thought that was the most boring and most ridiculous game ever, because for me, I thought being an adult was having responsibilities and not having any fun anymore and being boring.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that must have started from watching Hook.
That's a theme in lots of, like, I think for me, it started with Hook for sure, because it was such an important movie, but I think that's present in a lot of youth literature and youth movies.
Yeah. So
adults are boring.
I
want
to be
cool.
Like Peter
never
Pan.
Grow up.
Yeah. Never grow up.
Yeah.
Well, I think that people are starting to arrive, so let's let's step into the slow moving time machine.
Oh, yeah, like, heck yes.
Yeah. So I know you haven't seen it before. Are you excited?
I haven't seen it. I've heard about it. Wow, it's so nice.
Well, I'm glad that you're impressed.
Oh, wow, this is felt.
That is, but this over here is plastic.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, I wish that there wasn't so much of it made of plastic, but.
Well, let's get it.
It's the materials that I had to work with, okay? So.
Let's hop in.
All right, so here we are. This movie time machine is the inside as interesting as the outside?
It's like H.G. Wells's time machine with like brass gilding and a fancy chair. Well, there's two chairs.
Yeah, but mine is a little fancier.
Yes, as the host, I'm just the special guest.
I mean, if you want to, we can switch seats.
Okay.
Oh, all right.
Wow, this is nice.
Go ahead. Come on.
Okay, I can't. No,
okay, move.
We're actually switching seats.
Yes, we're switching seats.
Okay, wow.
Oh. Uh-oh. I'm dropping everything. See what you did, Aaron?
Okay, I'm ready.
Are you ready? Okay, so just to let you know, like, when we get moving, you have split your existence into two. So you're out there watching the movie with everyone else.
I've listened while to the podcast also in, before.
Okay, that's right. Sorry. I didn't mean to insult you. Are you insulted?
No.
Okay. So, and I have a lot to tell you. I do. Before we get too deep into the story, I want to go over the cast.
Please, I've been waiting for this.
Okay, great, because I've got a lot of interesting stuff to tell you about the cast.
I've got one in my back pocket to tell you, which I'm sure you already know.
Well, I'll let you tell me.
Okay.
And I'll react as if I don't know.
Okay.
Okay, so no one will ever know.
Okay.
All right, so just in case there's anyone out there that's never seen the movie before or you haven't watched it yet, there might be a few spoilers. Okay, so the cast is unusually star-studded for a Steven Spielberg movie. Did you realize it was Steven Spielberg?
I certainly, no. I would say that, no. I had no idea it was Steven Spielberg even to this day. And as a kid, that definitely would not have been on my radar.
You know, I didn't realize it either until I started researching. So there you go. And so most of the stars were already pretty well established, which was something that he often preferred to avoid. So we have a lot of really famous people. So for Hook, it was
Dustin Hoffman,
and it seems like he was involved pretty fairly early on in the film, and he helped write some of the original script.
That's really
yeah.
The Dustin Hoffman, I'm ashamed to say the only movie I've ever seen with Dustin Hoffman is Meet the Fockers. And then when I learned that he was Hook, that just blew my mind. I was like, wow, that guy? Oh my God. Because I haven't seen many movies. I'm woefully undereducated.
I haven't seen a lot of Dustin Hoffman movies. I have seen The Graduate, though.
Yeah. But then I learned that, I was thrilled.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you something right now, and we'll see how it goes throughout the thing, but it looks like I printed these off, my notes off at FedEx, and it looks like as it switched from one page to another, there's like whole chunks that are missing.
Mm.
So, I think what it said was that three of Dustin Hoffman's children are in the movie.
What?
They have little cameos.
Are they his kids?
No. His actual children.
Are they, I mean, are they, they're not. They're not Robin Williams' kids.
Did I say Robin Williams?
No, you just, no. I mean, they're not Peter's kids. They're
No. They have like really small parts. So one of them is in the play at the beginning. And another one is in the Little League baseball game.
Hmm.
And and the other one, it looks like that is the one that was cut off.
Oh, what did the other one? Where was the other one, Bailey?
I'm trying to remember.
See, okay, you mentioned the play. Sorry to back. The play is the scene they included for kids like me who had no idea what Peter Pan was. The play is where they told you this is what Peter Pan actually is, and now we're gonna change it.
Yes, which is that the play within the movie is not actually the play that was written, because like the Peter Pan story was actually play. First,
yes,
then it was a book.
You're right.
but it's not, that's not the play, because
an adaptation within a movie, which is a spinoff of the,
yeah. And there's also a musical play, which that play isn't either. So like they made a new musical to put inside the movie.
It was purely to inform people like me what the actual story is.
Exactly.
Anyway, sorry.
I remembered what the other kid was. He was young Peter Pan in the montage where it shows Peter's history.
Wow, I don't remember that.
Okay. Well, you'll see
excited.
That later.
Yeah.
He's one of three, Dustin Hoffman we're still talking about. Mm-hmm. He's one of three cast members that was involved in more than one Peter Pan project. He had a role in Finding Neverland, which I think is just interesting that like more than one of these cast members was in another Peter Pan story. Now, before we move on to the next cast member, I do want to mention an alternate casting possibility
for Hook
was Donald Sutherland.
What? Weird.
Which all I can think of when I think of him is like the smell of blood because of... Because of the Hunger Games, because his gums were always bleeding. And at least I don't know if they say it in the movies, but they do say it in the books. And like that always really grossed me out, which that would have been really awkward if he had been cast. And I will get to that later.
Okay.
But the other alternate casting for the role of Hook was David Bowie.
What?
Yeah. He turned it down.
Did he say why?
No, I don't think he did. I couldn't find
it
anyway.
Honestly, I don't know how good that would have been, because it would have, he just has so much personality as himself in every movie I've seen him in.
But he's
which
great.
I guess is two movies, but
Labyrinth and
the weird space one.
Okay,
Man Who
so
Fell
not,
from Mars.
Okay,
is
so
that
not
what's
the
called?
Hunger.
No. But it would have been weird.
Yeah, it would have been different.
Because Hook,
certainly
the
would have
character
been different.
Hook's personality is so, like, the way I remember it is like, it's very sexy. Not like hot sexy, but it is like it is like it's dripping with something.
Hook?
Like I don't know what it's dripping with, but like
well, maybe that's another thing you can tell me about later.
Bowie would have just I don't know. Bowie would have just done it weird.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess Hook is weird, but anyway.
Okay, so now Peter Banning is played by...
Who?
Rob.
Who's Peter Banning?
Peter Banning.
Oh, that's his name.
Yeah, Peter Banning.
His name is Peter Banning?
Yes.
I did not know that.
I gotta take my jacket off. The slow-moving time machine is really hot.
You're telling me... You're like, it's the main character is who? Robin Williams.
Yes, thank you, Aaron.
And this is the movie when this is my Robin Williams touchstone movie. This is why I cried when he died.
It's Hook.
And it's why I cried every time I heard about him for the year after he died. And it's just Hook.
It's
very touching. And there were other Robin Williams movies for me, but it was all Hook.
Yeah. I agree.
It was incredible.
So Robin Williams said that this role was really difficult for him because of how inattentive, unimaginative, and mean the character is before he realized who he actually is.
He's charismatic but not likable.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it makes sense.
But he became really good friends with Steven Spielberg during this movie.
No kidding.
And so he's another one of the cast members that was in another Peter Pan project. And this one, I really enjoyed it. I actually looked this up and watched it. So 2 years before getting involved in Hook, Robin Williams hosted alongside Walter Cronkite, a Disney promotional video that centers around the world of Peter Pan called Back to Neverland, where it starts as a live action movie. And then Robin Williams is turned into a cartoon version of himself.
What?
As a lost boy.
When was this in relation to Hook?
2 years before.
Is that a coincidence? Is it just...
I think so. I mean, I found something... I'll get to it later, but Hook started off... like, when the very beginning stages of, like, let's make a Peter Pan movie. It was originally with Disney, and it later moved to a different studio. But I don't think that they're... there was a relation with him, like doing this and then getting pulled into Hook.
How I think bizarre. It's just,
yeah.
That seems so arbitrary to me because he's just like an adult, you know, an adult actor, and let's put him in an animated and he's going to be a lost boy.
Yeah. So it was part of an attraction at the Disney parks to demonstrate the magic of
okay,
Disney animation.
Okay. I see. He's animificated.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
So alternate casting for this role.
I don't want to hear this.
You don't want to hear this?
Well, no, I do want to hear it.
Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kevin Kline. Kevin Kline was actually originally cast, and then he backed out of it.
This is just, I no matter what names you had said, it's not, I wouldn't have liked it.
Okay. Well, let's move on.
But Tom Hanks, that's funny. That would have been different.
It would have been different. I think the thing is, like, it's interesting to imagine these different actors playing the role because, you know, they would have brought something entirely different.
It would have
been
so different, and it probably would have been great. But it's like when you're in love with Robin Williams and Hook, that's what you're in love with. Yeah. I don't know.
So moving on to Tinkerbell.
Yes.
Which I spoiled this off
you
mic
did.
For
you. I didn't know this until you told me.
You'd forgotten.
10 minutes before we recorded.
Tinkerbell is played by Julia Roberts.
What? I didn't know.
You're such a liar.
I did not know who that was when I was a kid. I didn't know who any of these people were when I was a kid, but Julia Roberts is one that I did not remember as an adult.
Right.
It's like, that blew my mind.
So she's a cast member that I have the most to say about.
Okay.
so buckle up. Buckle up. All right. Have you ever heard that Julia Roberts had a reputation for being difficult to work with?
I've never heard that.
Okay. Well, this is the movie that kind of bulked up that reputation. In fact, when asked if he would work with her again, Spielberg replied no.
What?
Later, he was more charitable in saying that it wasn't a good time for them to be working together. So that was...
Well, that's a very coy phrasing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is. but I kind of wonder, I feel like... Like sometimes, like looking back at the paparazzi and the tabloids at the time and the way that it was all, you know, handled, if you know, there wasn't kind of a patriarchal slant on things and if it was just kind of unfair in dealing with, you know, what she was going through, but you know, I'll explain a little bit
more. I'm sorry, you'll explain. Okay.
Yeah. I'll explain. Sorry. I'm providing
you're
exposition.
Me. You're teasing me. Yeah. I'm like, what do you mean paparazzi?
So here's what I know. It probably started with her flakiness in accepting the role and then changing her mind because she had been doing so many back-to-back productions that she was exhausted and thought that it was unwise for her to commit to the production. But her fiance, Kiefer Sutherland, remember how I mentioned Donald Sutherland earlier and how that casting would have been awkward? Well, here's why.
Oh.
Yeah, so Kiefer Sutherland convinced her to change her mind again and encouraged her to call and ask for her role back. And they were engaged. And shortly before the wedding date, she ended it abruptly and retreated to Ireland without any word.
What?
To avoid paparazzi and with a mutual friend of both hers and Kiefer's. And
what sort of mutual friend?
Well, I think they ended up dating later.
Oh.
Yeah. So Spielberg.
So this is the quote unquote bad. It's a bad time for us to be working together. This is the context for that.
Some of it, yeah.
Okay, that makes it make more sense.
So Steven Spielberg purportedly had to call her and threaten her with being fired to get her to come back to the States and finish the movie. So because they had to put production on hold. And once she returned, almost all of her scenes were green screened. So she was isolated and acting out against imaginary people. So she was stressed out and probably heartbroken. And so she was apparently so prickly with the crew that they dubbed her Tinker Hell.
Ugh.
And also during the production, she became so ill that she was hospitalized. And so I read some places that that it said it was a flu, but then a few that mentioned it was nervous exhaustion.
Wow.
And
she was going through a lot.
Yeah, I mean, she was in her early 20s.
What?
She was in her very early 20s.
You're kidding.
Yeah, and like, you know, was engaged to be married, broke it off, like freaked out, is exhausted from
demand movie star.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, like, you know, I think you're entitled to be unhappy and irritable.
For sure.
I mean, as an actor, you have to, like, put that aside, sure, but I just wonder, like, how fair everybody was being and, like, the way that they handled her.
Well, you said, like, the coverage. I wonder what it was like to, you know, there weren't the movie blogs back then, I guess. But, you know, I wonder, like, what the buzz around this was during production. Like, but also you mentioned the green screen. The scene I told you, I mentioned that I remembered of her getting emotional about her feelings towards Peter Banning. Like, I have a vivid memory of that in my head, and I believe it is just her, because she's small, right? Mm-hmm. So in the movie, she's a fairy. And I remember that being a very odd scene, because it would cut back and forth between little tiny Tinkerbell and this and the full-grown man. And that, yeah,
I think that's very interesting. Like, in that the scene of that movie is one of the only times that she actually works with a real actor, because she, at one point she grows.
Wow, I forgot that. Oh my
God.
Yeah,
I'm sorry
to
spoil that.
No, she gets big. Yeah, spoilers.
I'm sorry about that. But I think it's important to note that that's the only, like, really the only scene that she had direct contact with another actor in the scene.
Oh, wow.
So alternate casting for this role was Winona Ryder.
Whoa. I would have liked that.
Rebecca De Mornay and Sherilyn Fenn.
I'm afraid I don't know them.
Okay. Well, Sherilyn Fenn was in Twin Peaks.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Oh, good. Nothing's cut off. So Smee.
I have no idea who that is. I remember, I can see him in my head.
Okay. It was a British actor named Bob Hoskins. And I love Bob Hoskins. Okay. I love him. He was in Who Framed Roger Rabbit? He was the detective in that. Hmm. And he was also Mario in the Mario Brothers movie.
Okay.
Which apparently, like, he didn't know he was signing on to a video game movie when he
just said, I'm an Italian plumber. Great.
He just said, like, some things about this seem appealing to me. And then, like, I think it was like the casting and the director or the something like that. So from everything I read, it seems that Bob Hoskins was just a truly kind person. And after a really long, difficult scene was cut, just like, you know, I guess they decided not to use it. He bought beer for over 300 extras as a thank you, as like, we did it.
Oh my gosh. There was a huge scene with extras, and it was, you know, difficult and traumatizing for everybody. And then they didn't use it. And the good guy Smee came in.
Yeah, it's like, here's beer.
Yeah. Smee is an interesting character, because you can't figure out whether, you know whose side he's on, but you can't figure out, like, he's so likable. Is this a good guy or a bad guy?
Yeah, that's
As
true.
A kid, you're like, good guy or bad guy?
I think he's just completely loyal to Hook.
Good guy, bad guy. Yeah. Well, you know whose side he's on. Yeah.
Well, but I think he loves Hook.
Yeah.
And okay, so he's the third cast member to be on a second Peter Pan production. He actually reprised his role as Smee in a TV miniseries called Neverland. I tried watching a little bit of that, and then I didn't know. Well, it wasn't for me. Mm. So, all right, Granny Wendy,
of course,
is
good old Professor McGonagall.
Yes, Maggie Smith.
Yes.
And here's a crazy thing. She was only 56 when they filmed this.
So as a kid, I see her as like an ancient woman.
Well, but she was supposed to be 92 in the
really?
Movie.
Okay.
Yes.
Did they age her up?
Yes, they aged her with makeup. And also, she's just an amazing actor.
Oh, I know she's incredible.
She's incredible.
Oh, Peter,
I mean,
you've
like,
forgotten how to fly.
The thing is, like, when I saw her as a Professor McGonagall in Hogwarts, you know, that was like 10 years later or so. And I remember recognizing her right away, and I was like, wow.
She hasn't aged a bit.
She's moving around a lot better. She hasn't aged a bit. I was like, she's a vampire. She's just like turned into a vampire at an older age.
Wow,
and I was like, there's still hope for me. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, you were in high school when Harry Potter came out. Oh my God.
Shut up. All right. So, just a few more.
Please, yeah.
Home Run Jack, the kid.
No recollection.
Banning's, Peter Banning's son.
Oh, the little kid with the baseball.
He was played by Charlie Cosmo. And he was in several movies when he was a kid, but now he's a professor of law, so he completely changed directions.
Wow. And that's what he tells all his students on curriculum day, you know?
Yeah. It's like, here, watch my IMDb
Fun fact catalog. About me.
Maggie, the daughter, is played by someone named Amber Scott.
Hmm.
And this was her only IMDb credit. I put this one on in the end because, like, he's the popular character, uh-huh. and I learned that he's uh-huh. your favorite. Yes. So Rufio,
yes,
is played by Dante Basco.
Mm, yes, he is.
So he got the part because he was the only one that auditioned that scared Steven Spielberg.
Ugh, wow.
And this may interest you.
Hmm.
He was part of a short film called Bangarang. In 2017, that gives the backstory of Rufio.
I had no idea. I can't believe I didn't know that.
Yep.
Bangarang.
Yeah, and one more thing before we move on.
No, this is my thing. I have to tell you something about
Oh,
him.
Okay.
Yeah, is that he's Zuko in Avatar: The Last Airbender, the animated series, not the movie. Yes.
Wow.
And it's his voice is so. If you have seen Hook, you know how distinctive his voice is. So anybody that's seen Hook and then watches Avatar, is just immediate. You can just be like, that is Rufio.
That's so astounding. Cool.
We're getting a thumbs up from Eric.
Yeah, that's good.
Double thumbs up.
Are you a fan of Avatar?
Oh
yeah.
I love
Avatar's
Avatar.
Great.
But it's the exact same voice. It's so full of character and, you know, gravel and or sand. but it's unmistakable. If you know one and watch the other, it's just instant.
Next time I watch Avatar: The Last Airbender, I'll be mindful.
Oh, it's you are the pan.
Very good, Aaron. So, okay, one more thing before we move on to the story of the production. So in 2016, it was the 25th anniversary of Hook. And there was a photo shoot reunion of all the Lost Boys, and you can find all of their like then and now side by side photos.
Oh, I don't know about that.
They're just super cute.
Oh, really?
They really are. They're really cute. Like they do a lot of like they try to do the same poses and like similar clothing. So they just look like a whole bunch of grown up hipsters.
Yes,
but it's super cute. Okay. So the few other Easter eggs in the film, and some of them you might already know.
I don't think so. Let's see.
Okay. So here's the well-known ones. Do you know who was the pirate that was put in the boo box?
No, I have no idea.
Glenn Close.
Oh my God.
Yes.
I don't know who that is.
Oh my God.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, everybody else will, you know, we're just going to move
all right.
on. Because
all right. Listening audience.
I don't think we need to explain
okay,
for anybody
please.
Else.
Okay.
I'll no, fill you in later.
I appreciate that. No, I'll look it up later.
Okay. Young Wendy is played by Gwyneth Paltrow and is her second role.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, it was her second role ever. The floating kissing couple on the bridge.
I got nothing.
George Lucas and Carrie Fisher.
What?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, here's the lesser known ones. The pirate that tries to steal Peter's shoes was played by Jimmy Buffett.
What? What are you? I feel like you're just saying no, random sentences.
I think that people just wanted to be a part of this. The pirate that leads the others with Jack's watch on a pillow is Steven Spielberg.
Oh, my God.
And the detective that talks to him after the children go missing is Phil Collins.
How did this happen?
Well,
just everybody who's in Steven Spielberg's address book in 1999 or whatever.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess like just goes through like, we're doing this big thing. You want to be a pirate? Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. So, okay.
Does George Lucas smooch Carrie Fisher?
Well, I mean, they're embracing. It's kind of far away.
Okay.
You'll see.
I don't remember this at all.
You'll see. Yeah. You'd never be able to tell who they are. It's it's kind of just like a little
wow
secret.
Carrie Fisher.
Yeah. Okay. So Carrie Fisher actually wrote some of the lines for Tinkerbell, but she's not credited.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There were other people that were brought in to help lines for like other characters, but and they were credited, but Carrie Fisher wasn't.
How odd.
And they were men. So just saying.
How odd. I didn't know that that was a practice that people did.
Yeah.
Bringing people in to write. Anyway.
Okay. So Spielberg always had a special place in his heart for Peter Pan. So naturally, there was a great interest in directing a Pan film. Discussions of a Peter Pan film first began in 1983 after his success with E.T., where he collaborated with another big fan of Peter Pan, Michael Jackson.
Whoa.
Now, Michael Jackson had contributed to the soundtrack of E.T. Damn it. And this is part that's like missing. So I'm going to try to fill in the blanks. So they had this idea that they would make a Peter Pan movie together, and it would be a musical, and Michael would appear in the titular role of Peter, and he would help with writing the musical numbers.
What a different movie.
Yeah. So the idea was to come back to the movie after Steven Spielberg finished The Temple of Doom, but in 1986, Steven Spielberg lost the rights to J.M. Barrie's writing to the Egyptian film producer Dodi Fayed, who later died in the same car crash that killed Princess Diana.
What?
So Fayed claimed that Michael Jackson was too expensive to include in the cast and that he did not need a prominent director. So, although like I also read that Steven Spielberg chose not to be part of it because he wanted to be around his new son. So who knows?
Hmm.
The project moved from Disney to Paramount and finally to TriStar, where Fayed sold his rights in exchange for an executive producer credit. And the writer, James V. Hart, had been working on the script with Dustin Hoffman, who had by that time been cast as Hook. And the concept for the script had been inspired by Hart's son, who drew a picture of Captain Hook and the crocodile and said that Hook wasn't really eaten. He got away.
Hmm.
And asked his fathers, like, what would happen if Peter Pan grew up?
Wow.
Yeah.
That reminds me of the Rudyard Kipling, you know, like, I guess they say that Rudyard Kipling came up with the Jungle Book because his son asked him to tell him a story about it.
That's amazing. You
know? Yeah. Just, it's very.
I love that.
Yeah.
Okay. So once the project had moved to TriStar, the film was slated to be directed by Nick Castle, who was Michael Myers in Halloween. and he later directed The Last Starfighter and Dennis the Menace. But before all that, he was Michael Myers.
Cool.
He was inevitably pushed out with a $500,000 settlement, and Steven Spielberg was put back on the project. With him back on schedule with the Peter Pan project, I'm sure he felt accountability toward Michael Jackson. So he called up Michael Jackson and said, this is the way that the project is going. Peter Pan has grown up. He's a stuffy, high-powered lawyer and has forgotten who he is and how to use his imagination.
Mm.
And both of them together apparently decided that Michael Jackson wasn't suitable for the role of Peter Pan.
Yeah.
But apparently Michael Jackson held a grudge against Steven Spielberg for years. Yeah. So, of course, the score of the movie is written by John Williams. Surprise, surprise, right? Steven Spielberg and John Williams again. So back in 1985, when they first started thinking about writing music for a Peter Pan movie, John Williams and lyricist Leslie Bricusse had been working on the idea that the project would be a musical and worked on adapting it for stage. So they were 10 songs in when the movie took a different direction, and they scrapped all of those songs except for two. Two of them made it into the score. So that was When You're Alone, the song that Maggie sings, and the song from the beginning of the play, play. And so for legal reasons, the rest of the songs that were written have never been heard or released since 1990.
Weird.
I'd be really curious to hear them. So there were the production of Hook took up 9 sound stages, and Hook's cabin was originally supposed to rock with hydraulics.
Wow.
But it was determined it was too distracting from the dialogue.
Yeah.
So they stopped it. And the ship set was so large, like the actual full ship, that they couldn't get certain shots that opened doors to the soundstage. The original budget was $48 million, but it ended up somewhere between $60 and $80 million, because the shooting schedule ran 40 days over. So, that Steven Spielberg actually takes responsibility for this. He said that he wasn't really on his A game, and he had this sense of guilt over that. And I think that that actually contributed. I don't know if you realize this, but it's his least favorite of all of his movies.
I had no idea.
And a lot of critics too.
He likes it less than Temple of Doom.
Guess so.
I'm just kidding. That's just a little dig out there for the Indiana Jones people. Temple of Doom's vibe.
We're going to get some hate mail now.
Yeah. I saw it the other day for the first time. It's not as good as Hook. Come on.
No, I like Hook better. Yeah. I will say that.
Anyway.
Okay. Back on track. So it ended up being the 6th highest grossing pirate movie ever. And 4th highest grossing movie of 1991, but made a profit of $50 million for the studio, but was still considered a disappointment because it was easily overshadowed by Beauty and the Beast, which came out that same year.
The animated one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah, and critics weren't kind to it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Isn't that weird? Sad. It's weird. I don't understand
I've never met somebody who doesn't like Hook.
Okay, so we're getting close to the end. But,
yeah.
I want to talk about the cast of Lost Boys for a second.
Okay.
So, this was a hard production for Steven Spielberg. I think, you know, with all the stuff with Julia Roberts and then like going over budget, and he didn't really like how elaborate the sets were. And, on top of that, like all of the Lost Boys were apparently really unruly, and he had a hard time corralling them. But to not end on a bummer note, you know, the part at the end where
there's a bunch of kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. And
you're doing, yes. You're doing a motion in front of me, which I interpret exactly as what I thought it was.
Yeah. Which is,
do you want me to say?
Yeah, say it.
Okay. It's when Peter Pan is just basically deciding who the new leader is.
And he's handing off his sword.
Yes.
And, so the kids knew that was part of what was going to happen, but they had no idea who he was going to hand the sword to.
You're kidding.
So all of their expressions.
That kid's expression is for real.
Well, all of them. Like, as they're going through, they all think, like, he's going to hand it to me.
And they're thrilled because they're little kid actors.
Yes. And then when he hands it off to the one that he hands
he
it to.
He loses his little mind.
Yes.
He's so
it's
happy.
So precious.
I thought he was just a really good actor.
It's so cute.
Yeah.
So one more thing before we join everyone else.
That is
else.
Super cute.
It is really cute. I have a surprise for you.
Okay.
Hand me my bag since we moved seats. You know, you're in my chair now, so I need my bag.
It oh, it's heavy. Oh, my gosh.
It's not all for you. Calm down.
Oh, okay.
So in 1991, there was with the release of the film, there was a 99 card collection that was released at the same time, and I was able to get a couple boxes. So everyone that comes to the party tonight gets one of these as a special party favor.
What am I looking at?
And you get to have the first one.
Oh, it's beautiful. This box looks like a fireworks box from the 1980s.
It says 55 cents on top.
Oh my gosh. It says 59 cents. 55 cents. Super glossy movie cards. And there's Robin Williams locking his sword with Dustin Hoffman's Hook on the front. And inside, they look like little popcorn packets. And it says, eight glossy movie cards in one sticker.
I wouldn't stick them in the microwave.
And there's like 40 of them. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So if you're listening to it and you want one of these little packets, we're probably going to have a lot left over.
I think there's going to be some extras.
Yeah. So if you write a review and you send us your information, we will mail one of these in the mail to you along with one of our stickers.
That's legitimately, so, if I were a listener and not a special guest, I would do that. I would take you up on this.
So Instagram, or you can email us on our website, memorystatic.com.
Oh my gosh. These really are so cool.
Yeah.
I want to open it.
You'll open it.
Right now?
Yeah.
No.
Open it now or later, Eric.
Now. I'll open it now. Oh my gosh. I feel like I'm going to ruin the mintness of this. It says copyright 1990. 1991? When did this movie come
1991.
out?
1991.
I thought it was like 1999.
No.
Oh my gosh. You're telling me Maggie Smith is 56 and Julia Roberts is like 21. I'm like, I thought this movie came out in 1999. Jeez. Okay, I'm opening it. Yes. Oh, wow. Oh my gosh. It's like nine little, oh my God. These are glorious. Wow. On the front of each one, there's a picture and then a cartoon frame around it. And this one is like Tinkerbell as a cartoon and lots of little stars. And then Dustin Hoffman getting in Robin Williams' face. And there's no caption on this. The next one says, "Pan in a jam in a clam." And there's a picture of a giant clam. I don't remember that from the movie. This one says it's a picture of Captain Hook whispering in Peter Banning's son's ear, teaching him to be a pirate. And the caption is, "A chip off the old ... Hook." Oh my gosh, these are great. Wow.
Okay. All right. Oh. Well, I think that the movie's wrapping up out there. So we're going to step out of the slow moving time machine and rejoin the party. Gosh. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. Let's go.
Are you like enthralled?
I'm still looking at these cards, but I'm ready.
Okay,
I'm ready.
Okay,
let's
get
out of the machine.
Well, I need you to watch your step as you get out. So stop looking at the cards so you don't trip over the slow moving time machine.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Yeah, I'm getting out.
All right, well, we've just finished the movie Hook. Everybody, can I have your reaction? Yeah, that was pretty good. Aaron, how did you feel about it?
It's great. I remembered most of it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, were you quoting along with it?
No, but right before every single line, I knew what each line would be. It was like it was right on the top layer of my memory.
I saw you grabbing your face a lot.
Yeah. there's some like campy lines that they just really lean into in a way that I love.
That's great.
Like, my dad, you know, my dad's my happy thought.
It's true. Like towards the end, I was definitely tearing up. I don't know if everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This consensus. Sure. All right. So we're just kind of go straight into the questions. Is there anybody here that has some specific memories about watching this movie when they were little, like anything associated or related to?
So my house has the same kind of hook latches as in the movie. And so when I was little, that absolutely terrified me. And I would go around for like weeks afterward, making sure all the windows were latched. But it was like half being afraid of being kidnapped and half wanting to go to Neverland. And that because I knew somewhere in my head, I knew that hook could like open those from the outside. So it was like a two-folded habit for a while.
So I remember being very uncomfortable with this movie when I was little, and I didn't know why. And watching it now, I realize it was kind of in every scene with the Lost Boys, I got uncomfortable again, which is I thought was funny because those are the good guys But I think just the way that they interact with each other, that like hierarchy is based upon like who can throw the best insults at one another or shoot each other with these weird like fake bow and arrows. Yeah, that made me really uncomfortable again, even as an adult.
So I was actually an adopted child. So the part where they're talking about, you know, Wendy being the foster mother of a lot of these childs, it's just spine tingling for me every time. Additionally, after his children are kidnapped and he's drinking because of it right before Tinkerbell shows up, I was caught emulating his behavior with apple juice, drinking. And my parents grounded me for about a week because of it, you know, to discourage drinking as a future adult, which I definitely appreciate now that I'm that future adult. But yeah, so this movie really resonates for me in that way. So,
as a kid, my first exposure to this movie was in parts on cable TV. I believe I saw the like second half first over like broken commercial breaks and was utterly confused by the old Peter Pan young boy regaining childhood. I don't know, as a kid it seemed like a weird nightmare thing to me, and it also introduced a weird like slip possibility of time travel, kind of like, wait, so is he older? Like, so Wendy aged but Peter aged too but forgot. It was a weird, confusing movie in that sense for me as a kid, but it also kept me kind of like wanting to come back to this movie, even though as far as like Spielberg works goes, it's not one that I hear a lot of people talk about constantly.
I used to watch this movie at the Boys and Girls Club, Bolden, Johanna Street, Boys and Girls Club. Okay, got it. On Johanna Street in Austin. I went there a couple of summers and maybe after school. It's all sort of convoluted, but this was one of the movies that they would put on as we were being picked up. I'm really not sure why it was like very specifically this movie, but I was having a really horrible time. It was very like survival moment for me as a kid. I didn't have any friends. And this movie was not a comfort at all because I was a pretty fastidious, like, hated chaos kid, probably because I was forced to go to the Boys and Girls Club and didn't have any friends. And this movie really scared me because of the just people throwing food and people like, there's no time and no one's showering and there's no like, no one has their own space. Like everyone has to share the space all the time. And I was so anxious anyway that it really scared me watching it. But watching it now is interesting because I see, like, as a filmmaker, I see the like meticulous like action that, you know, the director, but then also like the AD, like everyone must have taken, like all these steps they must have taken to orchestrate every single sequence. So now I'm like, oh, if I just known that this was all super organized, maybe I would have enjoyed it, but probably not because that was a really dark time in my life.
Growing up, I think I remember most from this movie is when Peter Pan's sword, that golden sword, so awesome. I just remember that the most. His sword is so freaking great. Rufio and then Peter, when he gets it, it's just that sword is so cool. Like, that's that. And when Rufio dies, when he gets stabbed by Hook, and Peter like, no. And then you see like, he's like, they get a fan on him or whatever. And it's like, he's like blowing. It's like air blows on him. Like, those are the two things that I remember most from this movie is Peter Pan going, no. And like all the air blowing like wind in his face or whatever, and his whole body basically. And then that sword was like the coolest thing in the world.
This was like one of my favorite movies of all time when I was a kid. I probably have watched it at least 1,000 times, I would imagine. It was one of those that my brothers and I would watch over and over and over and over and over again. And my childhood was like a little bit on the rougher side, and my dad wasn't around a lot, and similar to like the dad in, you know, Peter Pan in the movie. And I think that's one of the things that resonated with me the most is I was like, maybe one day he'll become Peter Pan and like he'll come back and like all the imagination will come back and it'll be great, you know, and yeah, the end.
So the thing that I remembered, hello? Yes, good? Okay. All right, right in there. So my most vivid moment from the movie is like in my memory is also when Rufio dies, but like just the moment before, because Rufio is like such this interesting character, you know, like he's got this attitude of a teenager, but he's also like still respectful of the order that they have as like a group. You know, so when he dies, he's like showing off that teenage personality. And in a moment of arrogance, when he has Hook pinned, he says, "Looky, looky, I got Hooky." And that line is just burned into my brain.
It's
because
true,
like he's got him and then Hook immediately kills him. And
he makes some weird mistake with his sword.
Yeah. Anyway. I don't know. That's the main thing that I think I remembered from the movie, because like as soon as he said that, I was like, "Well, you're dead." Yeah. That's it.
All right. So apparently Steven Spielberg related to Peter Banning in a lot of ways that he wished he didn't. And one of those ways was that he was afraid of flying. He had a fear of flying. No, there were other reasons too, but like, he didn't spend enough time with his kids because he was busy with directing. So that was another reason. But yes, he was afraid of flying. So, does anybody have like memory of the first time they flew and if they were afraid or not?
So I wasn't afraid, but I think this is appropriate given what we just saw. The first time I flew on an aeroplane when I lived in El Paso. I went to live in Orlando, Florida, where Disney World exists. And I lived and worked for 10 months in Disney World, oddly enough. And I wasn't afraid to fly, but I just remember what I remember most is right before I got on the plane. This was the first time I was going to be away from home for an extended period of time. This was right after high school. My mom was just very emotional as I left her, and she just all of a sudden just started bawling as I was getting ready to go to TSA and say goodbye to her for 10 months basically, as I went to go on my own and be an adult for 10 months and work in the happiest place on earth, which I found very ironic. So so yeah.
I think I flew on a plane once when I was little. I don't really remember it. The one that I remember was the first time I flew alone. I think I was like 13 or something, and I was visiting a girlfriend over summer that had just moved. And my grandma took me to the airport, and she was terrified for me and was kind of like, "Oh, everything's, you know, just keep your backpack on you and just be careful, and you know, you just you know, just watch out," and you know, she's terrified, and I'm just like, "Yeah, grandma, I got this. Yeah, it's cool, like whatever, it's cool, I got this, I'm old enough, you know." And this other woman, I guess, had watched my grandma kind of fuss over me on this whole experience. And this is like the first flight that I really remember, and this woman, I guess, asked the stewardess, she's like, "Can you go get that girl?" And she bumped me up to first class, and I got to sit in first class, and it was awesome. And it was great. I wasn't scared. It was just really cool.
Sweet. I remember the first time I flew. It was when I moved from Pennsylvania to Seattle. I was maybe 4 years old, and I don't actually really remember the flight. I just remember when my parents told me that we were moving to Seattle. I was like, "Where's that?" And they're like, "Oh, it's like there's mountains there. It's cool. You'll like it." And I was like, "Can I climb the mountains?" And they're like, "Yeah, yeah, you can climb the mountains." I'm like, "Okay, cool. You sold me. We can move to Seattle. Permission granted." And then we got on a plane and we moved to Seattle.
I don't really remember the first time I flew because I was a baby, but the first time I remember flying, we were going to California to visit my aunt and uncle in LA. And I've always had trouble with my ears on airplanes. And when I was a baby, all I did was scream the whole time I was on an airplane. And yes, I was one of those kids. Yes. And the reason for that is because, like, my ears caused me a lot of pain on the descent. And they still do sometimes. But the first time I remember flying, we were on the descent until LA, and I just started crying because I was in third grade at the time, and I'm just pulling on my ears. My parents were trying to help me, and I remember that there was another passenger that felt really bad and was trying to give his advice because he felt like he knew what I was experiencing, and I see you laughing, but I see where you're going with that. But he said that he also had problems with his ears, and that one thing, because like everybody was always saying chew gum, chew gum, chew gum, but that doesn't help when you have problems with your inner ears. It just doesn't. It doesn't help to yawn. It doesn't help to stretch your jaw. It doesn't help to chew fucking gum.
Tell us how you really feel, Bailey.
I am. So he told me that the thing that helped him was to take two styrofoam cups and slam them against his ears, and that would relieve the pressure. And I've always remembered that because I've never tried it. But I was like, well, that guy knew what he was talking about, maybe.
Anybody else? Okay, cool.
The first time I flew, I was very young. I was probably about your age, like maybe four or something, somewhere on that age where you're like barely cognizant of existence. And I remember going up and the ears hurting and everything, and looking over and being really confused as to what was out the window, and it was explained to me that that was like the earth that you usually walk on. And there was this like terror and fascination with that as you're looking over the mountains and the various land features, which you then like associate with where you've walked. And the entire time I was terrified and fascinated, and to this day when I'm in the plane and I look out, it's that same feeling of absolute dread and wonder and amazement.
Okay. Oh, do you have another one?
I was just handing you the microphone.
Oh,
this
sorry.
Other one.
Sorry. Okay. What was my next question?
I don't know.
Oh, yes. All right. So one of the scenes that I think really stood out to me when I was little was the food fight scene. Because, like, you know, it's the moment that's the real turning point for Peter, and how, like, he's having trouble, you know, just really letting go. And then suddenly he's able to start imagining or imagine things. And this invisible food is now this like mushy, colorful stuff. And then they, like, you know, they had this huge food fight, and I always wondered what it was made out of. I heard someone say icing before, and that kind of just ruins the illusion. But, does anybody have any memories of food fights when they were in school?
Mine's not actually a food fight, but it's like close to the gross situation of that. I can't remember the name of the movie. They were all like the terrible Superman. There's like the shovel guy. Mystery Men. Yeah, okay. So Mystery Men came out when I was a kid, and all of us loved that movie. So our parents would take us to the movie theaters and just drop us off and leave us there by ourselves while we were, you know, like, I don't know, we had to have been like eight or something. And it was like me and my friends down the street, like a bunch of boys and the one girl who was my best friend. And the boys were really awful. And so what we did is we all sat in the front row and had all our popcorn and straws and sodas. And we would just make... we'd throw all the popcorn, but we'd also make spitballs in the straws and just shoot it at all of the mystery men's faces and be like, oh, look, he's got a booger now. This is great. So we were only throwing food at ourselves, but we were totally, totally making hell for those poor movie theater people.
Mine is very, very short in that there was once at my middle school, like, and a memo sent around. I'm not sure how, because we didn't have any way of doing that electronically. But there was some kind of thing about, like, we're going to have a giant food fight in the cafeteria. I remember I was in sixth grade and I was just dreading it, because as we know, I was obsessive compulsive and I hated any kind of like chaos or mess. Dreading it, dreading it, dreading it. And then the kid, oh God, the kid who organized it, like, it, like, this was not in my lunch period, as it turned out, but threw something and then was just immediately taken away just so fast, from what I heard. And I felt bad because I was supposed to be on the side of, like, ah, kids, yeah, we're gonna have a food fight, it's gonna be great. But I was just so relieved. Just, like, looking back, that was probably like a horrible experience for that kid, but it saved me a lot of anxiety. God, I'm the worst. I did like this movie. I did. It was a great movie. Sorry.
All my stories say otherwise. So just as a disclaimer here, I mean, I was one of the kids that was kind of like the teacher's assistant, you know? So I really wasn't as directly involved in this incident as I would like to think I was, but... I was in seventh grade. It was cafeteria period, where we were all playing board games and stuff. And someone or some group of people had organized a paperball fight where they stuffed their backpacks with paperballs to the point that by the time it was triggered and it was over with, you couldn't walk around in the cafeteria without, you know, your ankles, up to your ankles in paper balls. That's how big of a fight it was. Just all the students at once just pulled out paper balls and started just throwing them at each other. And we got, actually, after that incident, we were voted the worst disciplined class of our school district.
Congratulations.
Ever. So yeah, it was pretty amazing to be involved with that, you know, even though I was not that kind of student. But the amount of organization that went into this was just fantastical. It reminded me of that you know, the fight they had, the food fight they had, you know, in Hook. So
that's so good.
They came up with one after us, apparently.
All right. It's not exactly a food fight, but when I was younger, I went to a summer camp, and there is this tradition where the last year, the oldest kids in the camp would do some sort of prank. And my year went really, really overboard. And instead of doing a normal, like, small prank, we, in the middle of the night, it was a sleepaway camp, in the middle of the night, basically left our bunks and trashed the entire camp. It was horrible. There were probably 50 of us in that age range. People went into the cafeteria. They took all of the trays, put them on the floor, took all of the utensils, dumped them out, toilet papered everywhere. Looking back, it's really, really terrible. At the time, it was like, this is anarchy and it's great. We trashed everything. This was probably like from like midnight to 2, went back to bed. Our counselors kind of knew about it because it was a bit of a, like, it was a thing where you do a prank, and they knew we were doing this prank. Went back to bed. About an hour later, we get woken up. Counselors are crying. Everyone's in trouble. It's a really big deal. And until morning, we had to stay and clean everything up.
Oh.
This one didn't happen to me particularly, but to a group of my friends, which I thought was really cool. And honestly, I would love to make this a tradition in the future. A bunch of my friends in LA dumpster dive a lot. And so they get tons of free food. And right around Thanksgiving, you can get like full turkeys and pies and just mashed potatoes and sweet potatoes and all sorts of stuff. A lot of times, or most of the time, that food's still good. So what they did is they put up sheets of plastic all around this giant table that they built for like 20 of them. They all got in there, ate all of that they wanted, and then proceeded to have an amazing Thanksgiving turkey food fight. So, and they just threw all the food at each other and like all of this stuff, and then just, and it was great. I've seen all the pictures and it looks amazing. I definitely want to do that in the future.
Oh, that is so cool.
And it's free food because it's from the dumpster, so you don't have to worry about like, you know, wasting a bunch of money, you know.
Oh, Jeremy.
So I think for my friend's 11th birthday party, we had a silly string fight in his backyard. And about 5 minutes into that silly string fight, we ran out of silly string, as you're wont to do. We found out, 20 minutes after that, that his parents had recently purchased a large package of string cheese containers, like those, like the spray ones. So one of the most fun birthday parties I've ever had, but it took me a week to wash that smell out of my clothes.
Oh.
All right. One more question. What is your happy thought if you were able to get some fairy dust in order to fly? Yeah, everyone's, yeah, that's true. Everyone's uncomfortably shifting around like. I like going first. I'll go second.
So I don't know if this is a cheat or not, because it's more contextual than like solid, singular, and momental. But the feeling of seeing someone I haven't seen for a long time is kind of a happy thought. Like reconnecting with not so much reconnecting with a friend, but like I have friends and acquaintances and people, like I'll be in contact with the internet for a while, but I won't see them in person for a bit. I don't know, something about that meet space reunion is always like, it snaps the happiness factor in me.
I would say mine is the fact that, you know, I was adopted as a young child, and not only was I adopted, but I have two brothers, each a year apart from me, one older, one younger. And we were offered up, if you will, as a package deal. So it was the three of us or bust when it came to being adopted. And we found my parents, who was willing to adopt three boys, you know, which was completely unheard of. So yeah, whenever I watch this movie and I think back to that memory, it's definitely my happy moment, you know, knowing that, you know, we were given an opportunity that, you know, so many children like us were not given. So yeah, definitely a happy moment.
There's probably a lot around of happy moments, but the one that came to mind, the first one that came to mind, is when I built my first interactive installation and finally put it up, and it was working fully at Burning Man the first year, and the whole crew was around, and getting to sit back and stare at the thing I never thought was ever going to actually come out of my brain into reality, and then watching all of these random strangers just light up with joy, and I just bawled, and it was amazing, and the whole crew there, and it was that's probably one of my happiest moments.
I think, well, from the movie specifically, I love that Mr. Ages is in the movie. I never realized it until watching it today, that Mr. Ages from Secret of NIMH has lost his marbles the whole movie, and then he finds them at the end, and now they make him fly. Peter Pan makes him fly, so that's awesome. I love that. But I guess a happy thought is just kind of home, I guess, to be corny. Just thinking of thinking of mountains and always reminds me of home. So yeah.
So my happy thought is actually very recent, because it was only a few weeks ago.
Just after New Year's, Kate and I went on a vacation to Jamaica, and everything about it was amazing. So like there's a whole lot to unpack, but there was this one day where there was this moment, like around noon, sun is perfect, the smell of the ocean. I was just like standing there breathing it in. And I lost myself in that moment, and Kate saw me and said, "Oh, did you find your happy place?" And I was like, yeah, I did. And then that wasn't even the happy moment, though. This is just the rising action, because I had with me this waterproof ukulele with a psychedelic tie-dye pattern on it, because that's my thing. And we walked down the beach a bit more, and I was just like already on top of the world. And I sat down and like was just messing around with my uke, and this employee of the place where we were staying came up and was like, "Hey, do you actually play that? Could you play me a song?" And so I did, and I played this song that I wrote called "Love Is," and Bailey actually helped me come up with the chorus for that one. Kind of. yeah. we didn't write it, though. That's the thing. It was an improvisational epiphany. But anyway, that song is like my happy song. Specifically, I wrote it to have a happy song, and I played a happy song in my happy place, and it was not like I had ever played it before. You know, there was like some magic there that was exhilarating. And I feel like if I were ever to leave the ground from sheer emotion, it would probably be that moment.
With the ukulele.
Yeah. Woo! Sounds of the strings. That's me. Woo! Flying through the air. Right there. Yeah.
Okay.
And by the end of the song, the Jamaican guys were singing along, so that was cool.
That's true.
My happy thought, it might make me seem like a little bit of an asshole. But I was thinking about sort of like mundane, everyday, really happy things that make you feel really good. Mine's getting an A on a paper.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to wrap it up. Thank you, everybody, for coming.
Yeah, thanks.
So, Aaron.
Hey.
So, what are your, like, some thoughts after watching that movie? And
I remember it so well for having not seen it in 10 or 15 years, however long it was. And it's the parts that really stuck with me were the parts I still enjoy the best as an adult, which were some of the goofy lines I mentioned and the crazy.
You are the pan.
Yeah. It's so good. Like Rufio and just the concept of the whole setup with Maggie Smith being old Windy, and you know, the entire beginning is my favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
So we talked earlier at the very beginning. It was a long time ago, so mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to remember, especially after going through the slow moving time machine and rejoining ourselves and whatever and whatnot. Tinkerbell, that scene with Robin Williams and Julia Roberts, and she becomes big, and it's strange.
It's really strange.
So what are your thoughts about that now? Because I've got some theories.
You mean my. Okay, well.
Oh, yeah. Natalie's opening her cards. Oh, to explain what's happening right now, while Aaron is thinking about his answer, we handed out the cards to everybody at the game, and they've taken it upon themselves right now to try to organize all the backs of the stickers into the poster that you can make if you collect all of the pieces. So we're getting really close. So we'll send you on Instagram. If you're following us on Instagram, we will post the picture of this. Okay, Aaron.
Oh, it's large.
It is large.
Oh, I said that's what she said. Also, what about Hook's like detachable hook and the accessories he needs to put on them?
He has
a, I mean, he has a mitt. He has a mitt. So back to Tinkerbell.
He has at least four confirmed accessories. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. As like I said, as a kid, I didn't understand the Tinkerbell thing at all. I mean, I got the gist of it that they, you know, she loved him when he was a little kid, and now she still loves him. I get that, but it was a mystifying lull in the action as a kid, and I was trying to figure out as an adult, like what the hell it meant, and I was like, in my head, like I know it's not right, but it was like, she's. You know, teaching him to be an adult. It didn't make no sense. The scene makes no sense thematically to me.
So even now, even now,
I don't get it. I mean, like, cynically, it's like, okay, they had to have this, like, a love interest, sort of. But then she's so easily blown off by Peter.
Well, so my theory is that, you know, in I haven't read the book, but in the Disney Peter Pan, which I hope that accurately depicts the character of Tinkerbell. She is very jealous of Peter and Wendy. When Wendy comes, she's like constantly trying to sabotage Wendy. And so I think that she kind of has these feelings for Peter that she's never able to realize or express. And so, you know, she's had a lot of time away from Peter. Oh. And so in that moment, she says something about, like, why are you here? Mm. Like, do you remember what your purpose is? Like, what's your next adventure? And so she's trying to help him remember what he's there to do.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she does betray her own feelings. And so it's kind of this complex moment where she knows what she's trying to be unselfish, but at the same time, she has a moment of selfishness.
Well, and now that you mention it, she says that line, which is a little like, again, they really lean into the campiness where she's like, I have a feeling so big and I've never been big enough to express it until now. But it is like, oh, there's this zone of maturity and complex emotion that the kids and maybe Peter back then and maybe now didn't understand. And she, like you said, maybe in the Disney movies, she couldn't express it, but when she's big and adult, she can. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. Are there any other like moments that you remember, like, and recognize in a different way now that you've watched it this time
absolutely
around?
Number one is just the Lost Boys hideout. Like, as a kid, you're just like, this is the coolest thing ever. All they do is just like swing around and stuff. And as an adult, I'm embarrassed. Like, oh, I really grew up. It's just like, what is their existence? Like, what are they up to?
Oh,
like, and then they're just going to keep doing that. Like, they have a new leader now, and now that's just going to keep going. And there's no like foil anymore. Hook is gone.
I mean, Smee's like, still what there.
Is there? No, Smee is sweeping up cans in London. like it's just like those boys are just gonna forever.
True.
And it was like, it's disturbing, honestly.
Just living in that constant state of fun.
It's weird.
That's very disturbing to you.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry to say.
Because they've got no purpose.
Yeah, kind of. I'm really relieved when they get back to the real world. So that's definitely different than the way Natalie is nodding emphatically at me. And so that's very different from when I was a kid, where the Lost Boys world is the coolest thing ever. And it still is visually. Like, I'm not that heartless.
But it's at least, like, when they get home, they have this lightheartedness, especially Peter has this lightheartedness they didn't have before.
Yeah.
And then he wouldn't have been able to get. I mean, not all of us are privy to, like, a jaunt to Neverland to re-achieve that. So, so it's up to us to, like, remember what, you know, I mean.
Yes.
And for some of us, we have a summer camp we can go to and work at that. Oh. That helps us in that never-ending summer. All right. Do you have anything else to add before we end this?
Great. Nope.
I think... All right. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, like, how John wanted to end this, with a crow, a bangarang, or Rufio. But... Yes. So which one is... Which
Rufio.
One is it?
Rufio.
Rufio! 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 Rufio!
This memory static. Next time, return your videos here.
Has the greatest sense of honor.
Aye.
Them that mock his hand have ended up a goner. Where some have 10, he has but 5. While on his point, not one survives. Better your chance to take the dive than deal with the captain's hook.
Hook, hook,
the captain's hook.
Hook, hook,
the captain's hook.
Hook, hook,
the captain's hook.
There
was a lad who started up a rumor.
Aye.
That the good captain, he had no sense of humor.
Our
captain, oh, by his breeches, the lad was raised upon the mast for many days. For the crew to all appraise the whimsy of Captain Hook.
I love your captain.
Of Captain Hook.
Hook, hook,
hook. Captain Hook.
Hook, hook.
He's funny.
Hook,
Captain Hook.
Hook.
Ah. Follows him across the sea and committed after snatching off his hand.
The captain is forever stalked by the seedy men who would swallow the clock. The grinning beast, the fearsome cock, has a taste for the captain's hook.
Hook, hook,
hook,
hook, hook, hook, hook,
hook,
hook,
hook,
hook,
hook,
hook,
hook,
hook,
hook, hook,
hook, hook,
hook. The captain charts his course across the ocean, culturing a crew with mad devotion. Heave-a-ho, the cannon's blast, we raise the rudder on the mast. No other pirate shall surpass the glory of Captain Hook.
Hook, hook,
of Captain Hook.
Hook,
hook,
of Captain Hook.
Hook,
hook,
of Captain Hook.
Hook!
Memory Static is hosted by Bailey Moore and produced and edited by me, Eric Dumig. Special thanks to Aaron Price for being the guest on this month's episode. And again, special thanks to Chewy for hosting the party. Music for this episode is by Bailey and Cullen Moore, with special thanks to James Dykeman, Nico Champion, and Kate Windsor for lending their voices. If you like the show, you can subscribe at your favorite podcast hosting platform. And if you're on iTunes, please consider giving us a rate and review, as this will help us get the show out to more people. If you have questions about the show or want to come to one of our parties, you can reach out to us at memorystatic@gmail.com. As always, thanks to our party goers for coming on out and watching the movie with us. Thanks for listening.